Dress, the History of Fashion is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, Cassidy Zachary
and April Callahan. Dress listeners, today we pick back up with our conversation with Dr. Kate Annette Hitchcock. Kate is a professor emerita of the Wilson College of Textiles at North Carolina State University in Raleigh, North Carolina, and she has also taught at East Carolina University, Virginia Tech, and Savannah College of Art and Design. Earlier this week, we aired part one of this episode discussing her recently released book, The Intersection of Fashion and Disability, A Historical Analysis. The book spans more than 500 years of how individuals with disabilities have navigated the matter of clothing, dress, and fashion. And in part one, we chatted about the public perception of disabilities during the late Renaissance and early modern periods, and how these eras' made-to-measure model of clothing production allowed for customization, catering to the needs of differently abled bodies. We also spoke about some of the figures in history with disabilities and how their wardrobes factored into their daily lives.
And today, Kate joins us again to bring us into the 20th century to chat about some of the private and governmental initiatives which have literally shaped the intersection and future of dress and disability. Kate, welcome back.
Well, it's this point in the middle of the 20th century that we start to see philanthropic organizations and even governmental entities get involved in this very conversation that we're having right now, centering around the needs of the disabled. Clothing being a basic need for all of us. How did some of these organizations, whether they were private philanthropies or governmental entities, address this topic of dress in their initiatives?
Yeah, so again, I'll point to the Second World War as sort of a bit of a watershed, in at least in the U.S. During the Second World War, towards the end of the Second World War in this country, there was an army doctor by the name of Dr. Howard Rusk, who became known as the father of rehabilitation. He set up a clinic, an institution at New York University Medical Center, which is now, I think, Langone Health. So he was a real pioneer in terms of, again, looking at military personnel who were coming back from the front, from the war in general, and noticed that while they were being rehabbed quite well physically, once they left, in terms of clothing. And so what he did was made the great move of hiring a woman by the name of Helen Cookman, who was herself disabled. She was deaf, and she had made clothes to try and cover up her bulky hearing aids. But she'd also been an industrial designer. She designed uniforms, working uniforms. And so she had a background in the industry. And so he set up a clothing research foundation within this that was just supposed to do a research project. That's mm-hmm. what it started out as a research project. Eventually what happened, Ms. Cookman was, I wish I'd been able, some, you know, people in history you'd like to go back and talk to. I would like to.
Your fantasy dinner party guests.
Yes, there you go. I think she was a force that enough just for me and her to sit together. Maybe they would have, you know, had much of a word, but she decided, well, a book came out of this called Functional Fashions. There was a few other personnel on it, and I write quite a bit about this in my book. But basically, she looked at problems that, so she managed to condense issues, not necessarily by disability, but by the area of the body that was limited mm-hmm. in movement, and talked about some common solutions that she found as she did her big research project. Out of this, and that book still, I've got a copy of it. It's out of print, but you can get it on Etsy and eBay and places like that. It's called Functional Fashions. It's really the first sort of, it's almost like an encyclopedia of this topic. It's not a big volume by any means, but it does get into some really good detail with images and explanations and stuff. I think what's probably as important is that she was able to engage some well-known fashion designers.
Who our listeners are going to know these names when you're about to tell them.
Right. Bonnie Cashin was involved. Pauline Trugère was quite heavily involved. I did find mention of a young Jeffrey Bean as well.
Vera Maxwell.
Vera Maxwell, right. Hart, Schaffner and Marks, menswear. So the list was very, very interesting. I'm going to give a shout out to, at this point, to Natalie Wright, who was, she may still be a PhD student up at, I think, Wisconsin. Natalie and I have communicated. She is really literally writing the book on functional fashions and Helen Cook.
That's amazing. We would love to have her on the show when she's done.
Yeah, she has published a little bit already, but she's really been digging into the detail. And so she put together a great exhibition on functional fashions in, I think it was 2019, at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and wrote a wonderful blog about that. And that is still up on the internet, as far as I know. So you can see some great, great pictures, images, and her blog about the movement on there. So again, I'm not going to pretend to have to have done all of that research myself. That's Natalie's taking care of that beautifully. Now, one of the interesting thing about functional fashions, you know, I started off reading about this thinking, oh, this really changed the game and shifted everything. It didn't. It wrapped around 1964, 1965. I haven't found too many explanations as to why, and I've seen suggestions that it was a marketing issue. I think one of the problems we've had a lot in the intersection of fashion disability since the 1960s is getting the information out to the people who need it. And I've heard that over and over again. I still hear it now with the internet. It's like, just don't know that initiatives are out there. They don't know where to look.
Well, you point out one that I thought was really interesting that I think probably was doing a good job at this, I guess, Levi's. Could you tell us how they were marketing their adaptable line?
Yeah, I don't actually know how they were marketing because I couldn't find much information. I do know that Helen Cookman worked with Levi's in the early 1970s. They used a patent for some pants for a seated man in a wheelchair that had zippers on the side. I've put the patents, obviously it's in the public domain, so you can go online and look for patents by Helen Cookman. And then suddenly, when she passed, I think it was either 73 or 74, the program at Levi's stopped. There was some sort of limited advertising that I think they thought might be more like word of mouth. But it goes back to this industry perception that one of the things that I learned in my dissertation was that at the time, companies did not want to be seen as making stuff for people with disabilities. If they were fashion companies, that was not their market. They didn't see it as design for all or inclusive design. They saw it as a completely separate market and there was not enough money in it. I may get some pushback for that, but that's what I've read and the things people I've talked to, that's the status quo.
Yeah. Well, speaking of money, the 1970s is this period of federal legislation pertaining to disabilities. And that, in turn, also meant governmental funds for research and development for assistive devices and product design. So did that kind of infusion of research money parlay into the realm of clothing design as well? No?
Yes and no. I think it got into design. I still don't think it got as far as the retail market, the mainstream retail market. So yes, you're right. There was a lot of, you know, there was the Rehabilitation Act in 1973 that then gave rise to the ADA in 1990, both of which were like game changers for people with disabilities. In fact, there is clothing language in the ADA specifically related to employment for people with disabilities and the ability to find size. It's kind of buried, but it is in there. There was a huge upswing from about 1965 in terms of government-funded university-related research in this country. And a lot of that had to do with the ag extension programs. So those extension programs that were set up basically after the Second World War, land-grant universities like, you know, Virginia Tech and Michigan State and Iowa State and all of the big state program. Texas Tech is another big one. Texas Tech put out a lot of research in the late 60s, early 70s. So if you go through, if you're an academic and you go back to the literature, you'll see that there was just a ton of initiatives in the throughout the 70s and 80s. There was a wonderful program at Drexel University run by Dolores Quinn that I write quite a bit about. That sort of crossed the bridge between keeping stuff within the ivory tower. She did that I think was wonderful is that she asked Stephen Stipelman to do all the illustrations for that book. So it was really wonderful getting to know about that work. Design Without Limits, I think, is the name of the book. Again, out of print, but you can get them on eBay and kinds of outlets.
If you turn this clock forward 50 years, now we're kind of calling this realm adaptive design, right? Within that period, that's when this was born. Would you define that term as it stands today for our listeners? Today, friends.
Yeah, adaptive. It's an interesting term. I'm going to give a shout out to someone who I profile in the book, Lucy Jones, who graduated from Parsons. And she runs a company called Fora, which has got beautiful, beautiful wheelchair accessories. It's F-F-O-R-A. Lucy said to me once, I'm not keen on the term adaptive because, and I'm going to have to paraphrase her here. I hope I do it correctly. When you adapt something, it means that it wasn't designed right in the first place. Why can't we just design things correctly for the people who need them? And I've given a lot of thought to that because, yeah, I wouldn't, as a non-disabled person, how would I feel about that? I feel like good design should be, as far as possible, universal. I want to be able to use things really no matter my physical ability or cognitive ability for that matter, because this does, and even though I don't really write about cognitive ability, it's part of universal design. I think it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's Pollyanna-ish of me to imagine that every single product and service out there can be made to fit everybody's needs. That's not really feasible. And I also understand that, going back to terminology again, because I'm a words person, every era has its name that it needs to collectively describe something. I think it's a great thing that we are talking about, who are prepared to market to people who have disabilities and to embrace disabled models and for Vogue to put disabled models on their cover. We, in the last literally 5 years, have seen such a huge upswing in PUC that for the word adapted or adaptive to be used, I'm not going to really argue with it too much. We're using that term. That's great. It's more important that the things are being discussed than I think the word that we're using to describe it.
Yeah, the needle has moved.
And I think that I also think just one other thing is that I think people out in the community understand the word adaptive, whereas inclusive is something a bit more nebulous and a bit more vague. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, never before in history has so much creativity and so much care been directed towards this very specific nexus of fashion and disability. Dress listeners, did you know that you can save on everything from fashion to beauty, home decor to groceries, even kids' school supplies with Rakuten?
Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. Beauty, clothing, electronics, home, department stores, pets, you name it. You're already shopping at your favorite stores, so why not be saving while doing it? It really is a no-brainer.
How does it work, you ask? Well, stores pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members. You get paid via a check or PayPal quarterly.
Membership is free, and it's easy to sign up. So join the 17 million members who have already saved at their favorite brands. Start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. That's Rakuten.com.
Dress listeners, whatever your reason for wanting to learn a new language, whether it's an upcoming international adventure, communicating with your friends and family abroad, or even professional purposes, Rosetta Stone has got you covered.
As the trusted expert in language learning for 30 years now, you can join millions of Rosetta Stone users to learn any of the 25 languages offered. That includes Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, and so many more.
And this is fast language acquisition, friends. There are no English translations, so you learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. And right now, you can get lifetime access to all 25 of Rosetta Stone's language courses for 50% off. That's language learning for 25 languages for the rest of your life, which, Cass, is frankly amazing.
It is. And what are you waiting for, dress listeners? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Stop in and save big money on your next outdoor lumber project now at Menards. Menards has the largest selection of AC2 pressure-treated lumber and decking, and it's easy to load in our outdoor lumber yard. Plus, you can get free estimates fast with our deck design program in-store or on Menards.com. Check out our weekly flyer for more great deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
So, I mean, again, we could probably do an entire podcast episode on this question that I'm about to ask you. But who are some of significant organizations and individuals who are working in this realm today? The list is long, so I know that you're just going to have to pick a few.
Yeah, and I'm going to miss many, so my apologies up front. I have to talk about Izzy Camilleri first and Izzy Adaptive. I think the first time I saw Izzy's website was, it may have been 10 years ago, Canadian designer. And they had a wonderful exhibit on her work in Toronto as well. So Izzy Adaptive, first time I'd seen leather jackets in a wheelchair, like really beautiful leather jackets too. So she's done an amazing, I pulled her work up as sort of a gold standard personally. As far as mainstream retail, I love what Target is embracing. Footwear is another company, and I've talked to Billy a bit. He's profiled in the book, and his shoes have been picked up and copied everywhere now. You see a lot of Billy footwear styles being used. Liberari is another brand that I really like, and then Unhidden. There's a number of retailers. I think there's more retailers than we know about. Like Victoria's Secret are doing adaptive underwear. There are many retailers who are taking a portion of their inventory and making it adaptive, and they may not be sort of blowing it up on Instagram, for example. Decathlon, which is a sports store in Europe, is doing some adaptive stuff as well. So as far as organizations go, obviously, you know, Runway of Dreams has done an amazing job about bringing the topic to the forefront of fashion. I think what British Vogue did last year with Selma Blair and some of the other models that were on the cover has really changed the game. Open Style Lab in New York is another organization that is doing some wonderful stuff. Yeah, there's a lot out there right now. And like, I apologize for people, I've missed some obvious things, but I know we're short on time.
Yeah. And, you know, I just can't wait to see how this grows. In the latest Costume Institute exhibition, Women Dressing Women, there was an adaptive entire look included in the exhibition by Colleen Estrada, as modeled by Erin Rose Phillips. And they even had a custom mannequin of Erin Rose made as well for that exhibition. So Hopefully we will see more of this. And again, Kate, thank you so much. We could have made multiple episodes out of this discussion today. So listeners, you're just going to have to get your hand on Kate's book to learn all about the things that we didn't have time to cover today. Kate, thank you so much for joining us.
April, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Kate, thank you so much for joining us for this week to stimulate all of our thoughts about the power of dress design and disability. You know, this is an enormous topic and one that is very much on the minds of many designers and design collectives currently. So listeners, if you would like us to do more episodes on this topic, please let us know. We are very happy to. And actually, I have a couple people already on my list, Aaron Rose Phillips, to come on the show. So stay tuned.
Yes. And I also mean what I said about having Natalie Wright on after she finishes her book on functional fashions and the myriad of important American designers who participated in that initiative. And Cass, you know me, of course, I totally rabbit-holed as soon as Kate mentioned this. I was like, okay, is Natalie's book out yet? Okay, no, it's not. What else has she published about this already? So I did find what she had published already, and now I'm even more intrigued. Just to add on a little bit to what Kate already mentioned in the episode when she was telling us about Helen Cookman, who is, of course, the hearing-impaired designer of the functional fashions line. Helen Cookman, she did a 3-year residency at NYU to develop this initiative. And then she also partnered, and Cass, you're going to find this very interesting, with the renowned fashion editor Virginia Pope to help produce and promote this functional fashions line. And it ran for almost 20 years, from 1958 to 1976.
Yeah, and with Pope's backing, they showed the functional fashion line at New York Press Week, which was the precursor to New York Fashion Week. And April, I didn't know what we now call adaptive design had this whole long history in terms of the high fashion world promoting and embracing it. Did you?
No, I didn't. And also, there's like so much more to all of this. I don't want to give too much away in the case that Natalie does join us on the show, but she notes in her work that this was actually the functional fashions was a kind of a multi-pronged initiative. She writes that, quote, there was a mail order catalog for Cookman's ensembles requesting that other designers incorporate Cookman's original construction solutions into their own creations. And then also this other offshoot of the initiative was identifying garments that they deemed already functional, end quote. And in this last category of garments already deemed functional, one of the main participants in this realm was Bonnie Cashin. Mm-hmm. And this makes perfect sense, given that her work is frequently draped and inspired and took a lot of inspiration by, quote unquote, non-Western styles of dress. And this is, of course, something that Kate and I chatted about briefly in part one of the episode in terms of draped styles of clothing in the context of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, allowing for and accommodating disabilities. So again, so much more to say on this topic.
Yeah. And of course, while Cashin's designs were designated as inherently functional, other really big companies like Levi's in the 1970s were forging new territory in incorporating Cookman's design solutions into their mass-produced offerings. So they produced things like stretched denim jeans, which was really a novelty at the time, and which we've actually done in a past episode about. It was really fascinating. Yeah. And these jeans featured zippers that open and closed each leg for ease of dressing. And they did not sacrifice style. They featured Western-style pockets and colored top stitching. And they were advertised at doctor's offices. And the Levi's, what we would now call an adaptive line of the 1970s, never really reached the mainstream like how perhaps Tommy Hilfiger's adaptive line has now. But it's really important to note that this was 50 years ago at this point. So there's just so much more to unpack in terms of the history of adaptive and universal design movements that are getting some much deserved attention today.
Yes. And I think that I would very much like to work more on this topic. So again, listeners, if you want to hear more about this, let us know. I will, of course, see if Natalie would like to join us when she finishes her book to chat more about Helen Cookman and functional fashions. And also, Cass and I have been wanting to invite some models and designers working in this realm of disability on the show for a while. Sinead Burke has been on our list for some time. We would love to have her if she would join us.
Yes, absolutely. Well, dress listeners, that does it on this topic for this week. May you consider how the ease of your clothing impacts your daily life next time you get dressed. Remember, we love hearing from you, so if you'd like to write to us, you can do so at hello@dresshistory.com. You can also DM us on Instagram at dressed_podcast, which is where we post images and reels to accompany each week's episodes. And if you'd like to search for this episode's Instagram content, you can search the hashtag dressed367.
You can also find us on our website, which is dressedhistory.com. And there you can find information about any of our upcoming classes, trips, and tours. And Cass, you have a new class open for registration. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about it?
Yes, I am so excited to bring you What Women Wore to the Revolution Part 2. You do not have had to have taken Part 1 to enjoy this class, but basically we are continuing our exploration into the evolution and revolution of women's fashion across some of the most iconic eras in fashion history. So I'm talking about the 1930s, where you have, you know, this crazy dichotomy between the reality of the Great Depression and the haute glam of like high fashion and Hollywood. Yes, exactly. So we'll delve into that. And the 40s is, of course, defined really by World War II and what women wore to work, but also how they used their bodies and their dress bodies as acts to represent acts of subversion, like things like the French Resistance, but also in places like Japanese internment camps in America. And then we move into the 50s, which of course is the high fashion era of the golden age of haute couture. And I'm actually going to take you behind the scenes to meet a lot of those women who worked behind the scenes in the haute couture industry. So not necessarily the designers, although we'll certainly meet some of them, but the models, the fashion editors, all these women behind the scenes that are really instrumental to forging the success of that industry in America and in Europe. And then moving into the 60s, which is the fashion revolution, where everyone thought they knew about fashion and the dress body and the gender binary all goes out the window. It's so crazy when you compare the 50s to the 60s to see that drastic change. So it's going to be really fun, and I hope you will join me.
Yeah, and even the business of fashion changed in the 1960s, it must be said as well.
Yes, there's so much to discuss, so we'll see how I cram it into 1 hour once a month. But I always do my best.
Sometimes Cass and I are like doing these classes, and we're like, why did we decide to talk about so much stuff in 45 minutes to 1 hour?
It's hard not to.
More than we can chew. Okay, friends, if you live or find yourself in New York City, please consider coming to join me at the Metropolitan Museum of Art for a 90-minute exploration of art and fashion history. These are, of course, my fashion history tours of the Met, where I take you to some of the most hidden recesses in the museum as we seek out 10 of the museum's most fashionable masterpieces. And we're having a blast so far on all these tours. And I will say this, we have had many, many, many New Yorkers join this tour who have afterwards said, wow, I did not know that that part of the Met existed, and I come here all the time. I'm a member. I'm here all the time. So I'm just saying, I'm out here working for you all to make some very fun experiences. And this week, it's actually on my agenda to start to begin to develop additional tours of the Met's permanent collection with specialty topics. So in the next coming weeks, those will be available soon. So I'm teasing it now.
Very exciting. And speaking of tours, we may or may not have a New York day tour up our sleeves this coming late summer, but more on that soon. But until then, our initial week of our fall 2024 fashion history trip to Paris has sold out. Please put your name on the wait list if you'd like to join us for that first week. But also, we are considering adding a second week that would run October 12th through the 19th if enough people gauge their interest, because we would love to do that for you all. So if you want more information, including how to register your interest in this potential second week, just email us at hello@dressedhistory.com and we will get back to you. Thank you all, as always, for all your continued support. More dress coming your way next week. Dress the History of Fashion is a production of Dress Media.